I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the horror that was visited on the Boston Marathon yesterday. We're going to talk about how well Indianapolis is prepared for such assaults on public safety and what it takes to get ready for such attacks. But we're also going to discuss what something like this does to a community, to a state, to a nation, to the world. We have a great group of guests, but this is a show we need your help with because its focus is on how we as people deal with shared threats, shared challenges, shared grief, and shared hopes. Please call in at 1-866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We have a special show today. We're going to be talking in the aftermath of the tragedy at the Boston Marathon yesterday about Indianapolis emergency preparedness. Should start the program by thanking our previously scheduled guests. We were going to be talking about Indy food trucks today, and they have graciously agreed to postpone their visit and come in at another time. I'd like to invite you to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are Megan Bulla, who is the communications manager for the 500 Festival. Megan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. And Betty Dobkins, who is Director of Safety and Security for Indianapolis Downtown Incorporated. Betty, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for keeping the public informed.
We're going to do our best today. I want to start, in some sense, see if we can provide some reassurance here. In terms of safety, we've obviously got, you know, one of the world's largest sporting events coming up next month. We have the largest half marathon in the world that's part of that, a parade, all sorts of public events. How safe are they? I'll start with Megan Bulla.
You know, we have a safety plan that's been in place. Each year we address it. We make changes. We tweak it. After hosting the Super Bowl, we kind of learned a lot from that. I think that event went really well. We worked with a lot of different departments to make sure our plan is as up-to-date as possible. Obviously, as we learn more of what happened in Boston, we will make adjustments to that plan. But right now, we're kind of in a holding pattern until we know more information. We can really figure out motives and logistics and kind of see where we can go from there.
And I probably should say, Betty, that you have expertise in this in another area, too, because you're a former Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department deputy chief as well. Is it possible to make an event like this completely safe?
Never. Even day-to-day living is not completely safe. You just, plan for the worst, hope for the best, and just kind of deal with the details and plan for all contingencies, from, a bombing, and just making sure that, the public has to take part in protecting each other and themselves and report when you see something that is suspicious. If you see it, tell someone.
What should some of the triggers be when you say you see something suspicious? What?
Unattended backpacks, big bulky things left out in the open. Now, in the Boston case, those things were hidden in trash cans. So I know Department of Public Works and the Police Department and Homeland Security will be looking at those things differently this time as far as, what do we allow on race routes, parade routes, big events, do we allow trash cans to be left? Once the dogs sniff these areas, it's public access. It's not restricted. So it's easier to conceal things in trash containers.
Are there sort of behavioral things that you should notice as well with people?
Sure. Although people who want to do bad things have gotten better at concealing their behavior too and acting like, you know, all of us who are participants or observers. So if you're looking for someone who's, say, going to do a suicide bomb, you know, look for somebody wearing bulky clothing, clothing that's not appropriate for the weather, especially in summertime and warmer weather. They're going to be wearing, you know, probably coats in order to hide their bulkiness. They might be appear to be different in their physical build, or excessive sweating, furtive movements, looking around nervously.
We are talking about Indianapolis emergency preparedness here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Jim. It says, as a member of the media, I not only enter the Speedway, but also the garage area, media center, and the tower while carrying a shoulder bag. These areas are filled with people from across the globe, especially on race day. The only time my bag has been inspected was once as I entered the garage area while candidate Hillary Clinton was visiting. With suspicions that yesterday's explosives may have been placed in backpacks or gym bags, wouldn't it be prudent to begin inspecting items as people enter these buildings and high visibility areas, or would that just be too overwhelming? Megan Bulla, I'll start with you.
Well, I'll start by saying the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is a separate organization than the 500 Festival, so they have their own sets of security measures that I'm not privy to all of them. But, you know, it's something that we're looking into. You have to also keep in mind that these events are very well attended. There are lots of people, and logistically, I don't know if it is possible to check every single person coming in and out of an area, especially for an event like ours, the parade downtown or the mini marathon, where it is an open area. It's not in one confined space. But these are things that we've not had to do in the past, but definitely are on our radar to see if we need to do that moving forward.
Does Betty Dobkins, does the fact that, like, with an event like the half marathon or the Boston Marathon, just that there's so much ground that you have to keep track of, add to the challenge?
And certainly I talked about a little bit about that before, because it's open access. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it is going to be easier for someone to, you know, hurt us. And there again, it's, you know, incumbent upon the public to be aware of your surroundings and look around. I know when I walk downtown, it's such, you know, a great place to be, and, you know, it's pretty, and I'll get to thinking and my mind will wander. But I still think that I need to be aware of my surroundings and who is around me. And it's the same thing when you're when you attend an event. You know who is around you, look around. You should always know where your exits are, even in a restaurant or a movie theater. So it's just being aware of your surroundings and who is around you. You may have to give a description of someone. And if you can remember, you know, even the Vegas thing, yeah, there was a man next to me, 5'11", wearing blue jeans, a red hoodie, you know, black Nikes. You know, just be aware of what's going on around you.
We are talking about emergency preparedness here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Megan Bulla, in terms of, you know, you've got major events that are open to, you know, thousands of people. What's the biggest headache in providing for safety and security there?
I would say our biggest challenge is also our biggest asset, is that we work with so many different departments. It's not a headache by any means, but it's a lot of people to keep in the know. It's a lot of people in that command center that need to be aware of what's going on. So a lot of it is just keeping the communication up to a certain level when all of these things are happening so quickly. Even on an event day that nothing happens, it's very challenging to make sure that everyone is communicated with in a timely manner.
Well, the Boston Marathon is, you know, the world's most famous marathon, and we have the world's largest half marathon here. When did you first find out about the explosions in Boston yesterday?
I was actually in a meeting, an internal meeting at the 500 Festival, and someone popped their head in and said, you know, hey, you need to look at the TV, something's going on. And I think that first reaction was was more of a human reaction of just shock and awe and trying to figure things out as everyone else was. You know, we all kind of met as a team and watched some of the coverage and immediately knew that we needed to reach out to our participants and let them know that we do have a safety plan in place. We are monitoring things very closely. So, you know, within the next few hours, we reached out through media, through an email to all of our participants, our website, social media, trying to let people know and feel rest assured that we do have a plan in place and the race will move forward.
Are there ways you're going to rejigger that plan based on, you said that it was a different kind of experience. What lessons have you drawn from it thus far?
I think it's very early right now to kind of talk about those changes, but we definitely are working with all the various public safety organizations just as they learn more in Boston, if they figure out more details that will help us plan logistically. But it might not even be something that people can see a change, but there will be an increase in safety. Maybe it's plainclothes officers. It may not look any different, but do know behind the scenes we are taking it very seriously and there will be changes made.
Betty Dodkins, what lessons do you see so far from this tragedy?
Well, as a matter of fact, this morning I had a meeting with Bankers Life Security Director John Ball, with our Department of Homeland Security Bill Gleason, and also our local Homeland Security Chief Gary Coons, and talking about, you know, the 500 Festival, also the Pacers playoffs. So already things are being put into place to address, you know, access to, you know, trash cans. So I know that the police department and Chief Coons will be working on the plan and checking over the 500 Festival mini marathon plan. And I'm sure that there are going to be some changes. I know in the past what they used to do, because the runners would come down prepared for whatever kind of weather they were encountering, and they had like cubbies where they strip off their things and everything was put in one place, you know, so that we would know as police officers if something was out of place, you know, backpacks, you know, just wasn't allowed. So I don't know if they still do that, but I'm sure that, you know, we're going to be, you know, thinking about those things again.
Would there be something, I ran the mini marathon probably a dozen times before my knees started to go. And I remember if you had a cold, rainy day, one of the ways that, you know, that you would preserve body heat until you got warmed up is literally you just wear a garbage bag over your body. But that could conceal an awful lot of things now, too. Is that something they'll revisit, what kind of attire you can have? Or
I can't speak to what Chief Coons will suggest, but honestly, I don't see that happening. We still have to live our daily lives and do what we do. And if a garbage bag is your best, a garbage bag can hide things, but so can a big raincoat.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about emergency preparedness here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, in terms of changes over time, what things might we look at, Megan Bulla?
Well, I think with the events industry, so many things have happened in the past year that have kind of triggered events on many levels, with the state fairground, stage collapse, things like that. Our plan got very specific, and if A happens, we automatically go into B. So it kind of takes some of the decision making out of things, and that's speaking more to a weather related issue. But these are all things that we kind of keep in mind and learn from, and move forward and try to make the best decisions possible.
And Betty Dodkins, in terms of planning for an event like the 500 and all of the attendant things that month-long thing. When does the planning start on something like that?
Oh, the planning never stops. They plan a year in advance, and then after the event, you have a debriefing, which, you know, is the after plan for the following year, you know, reviewing what went well, what do we need to tweak, and reacting to anything that may have happened. at the event. And that wouldn't necessarily even be a terrorist event. It's, you know, responding to, you know, injured people, injured runners. So it's just a plan that is looked at quite frequently.
And in terms of who are the players involved in that process, in terms of putting together that plan?
Well, now, I don't think I should speak for public safety, but I do know that Homeland Security Chief Gary Coons, the fire department, the police department, anyone who has any stake in this game is offering resources is at that planning table.
We are talking about Indianapolis emergency preparedness here on No Limits. My guests are Megan Bulla and Betty Dobkins. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indianapolis emergency preparedness. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Megan Bulla, who is the communications manager for the 500 Festival, and Betty Dobkins, who is director of safety and security, Indianapolis Downtown Incorporated. But we also, I should say, Indianapolis will be hosting a lot of visitors in the next few weeks. Many involve running or walking events. This morning, WFYI's Rick Dawson spoke with the race director of the One America 500 Festival Mini Marathon, Don Carr.
Can you tell me what you've heard and how things are changing in the planning process for the mini and other events?
Well, obviously, this is a extremely fluid situation where I'm sure local officials are learning as they go. And, you know, the mini marathon, we do have a little bit of a benefit that we've got a few weeks before that. So I know there'll be some additional meetings that will, you know, speak to this type of situation specifically. And, you know, we'll take the direction of local and, you know, city officials on this. So, and for the mini marathon itself, that's something the 500 Festival works with directly, and they're in close communications with the mayor's office and Homeland Security. So we'll just take the direction that we're given on that. Other local events, I know this week coming up is the Komen Indianapolis Race for the Cure, and same situation that I'm sure over the next few days, we'll be touching base with city officials just on any additional things that we'll look to them to give us guidance on anything that we should do differently. Although I think, you know, our general game plan has been strong, that we've always planned for a lot of scenarios, and we have emergency plans in place for everything from the weather to man-made incidents. So, you know, I feel fairly confident that we're, you know, already there as far as being a well-prepared event planning. So I think though that over the next few days we may learn some additional information that we'll just need to take those directions.
Help us understand how things are different when you're planning an event that snakes through a neighborhood or goes through areas where you can't, you know, check every person coming into that event like you could at, say, a stadium.
Correct. Yeah, we don't have that ability. You're right. It's a situation where, you know, you just have to rely upon, you know, the police officers, the volunteers. And now we're in a situation, I think, because of what happened at Boston, I think, you know, people are obviously going to be at a much more heightened, just going to be more alert, more vigilant, and you have to rely on everyone to look around themselves for anything that may look, you know, out of the ordinary, suspicious. It's going to take an effort from everyone, you know, for all events.
That was One America 500 Festival Mini Marathon Race Director Don Carr talking earlier this morning with WFYI's Rick Dawson. We are talking about Indianapolis emergency preparedness here on No Limits. My guests are Megan Bulla, who is the communications manager for the 500 Festival, and Betty Dobkins, who is director of safety and security of Indianapolis Downtown Incorporated. We've also just been joined by Indianapolis Fire Department Chief Brian Sanford. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, we've been talking really about how we try to avoid tragedies like this. But to some degree, I'm sure the folks in Boston went through all sorts of steps to try to avoid something like this, and disaster still struck. That's only half of the challenge, really. It's if something like this does happen, what do you do in the aftermath? What steps are important to making sure that we're prepared to deal with a tragedy, whether it's something like this or a more natural tragedy? Brian Sanford.
Well, obviously, anytime we're talking about a large event, particularly this event brings 35,000 people, so it's obviously a large event. We have event plans for just about every event that comes to Indianapolis. We grade the event as it comes, and with that grade comes a dedication of resources that we know that we would need if there should be an event that causes a mass casualty, injuries, and so forth. We plan pretty extensively with certainly all of our local agencies here at the city, but we also plan with partners in the state and the federal level, have a good accounting of all the assets we would need. We have good EMS or emergency medical services capability as well as the law enforcement side. And we have plans for mass casualty, both treating and hospital transport plans.
Help me a little bit in the, as I'm sitting and listening to this as just a layman, it strikes me that, we could have at any one given time major events going on out at the Speedway where we will have a crowd that can approach 250,000 people. Possibly the Indiana Pacers playing in a playoff game, which draws a lot more people down here. The Indianapolis Indians having a baseball game, and all of the other routine downtown nighttime activity. Do we have the infrastructure in place to handle all of that, or is it a strain? I'll start with Betty Dobkins.
There is infrastructure in place for just that, and yes, it's still a strain regardless of how many resources you have. In fact, if you recall, I don't know what year, the year the tornado came through when the 500 was letting out, came through, tore the roof off of a nursing home, mm-hmm. flooding, and yes, it was just unbelievable, and yet the police department, fire department responded to those two major incidents, and handled it quite well. And yes, it was a strain. Officers and I'm sure firefighters were working overtime. We had long shifts in order to address those issues. And as I recall, I remember being on the northwest side at a SWAT call out on a hostage situation. So yes, we were strained, but we handled it, and they can still handle it. And the plans in place, I'm sure Chief Sanford can back this up, that the first thing you do in these responses is address, all the medical issues. You close down that perimeter so that the investigation can get started so you don't lose evidence, protect the evidence, and then when you get those two things stabilized, then you start the mitigation process, and it can be done.
Is there ever a conversation, though, and I'm going to keep it on this point, we'll get to the investigative process later, but right now, what I'd be curious, is there ever a conversation that says, maybe we shouldn't have all of these events at the same time, or this wouldn't be a great idea to do all of this? Chief Sanford.
Yes, there is. When we are in the event planning stages, we talk about everything. And certainly the number of events going on at any one given point in time and the number of resources that are involved to be able to cover all those events, it is a part of the conversation. And it's, we know what we need to adequately have and remain on station to serve the public in general, whether there's an event or not. We know what levels we can go down to maintain that coverage. We see that even on a routine fire run. We have redundancy built in, for example, in coverage. And then as we look at having the event or not, there may come a point in time when we say, yes, we can do this, but we're going to have to bring this many people in off shift on overtime to cover it. So we have all the information. We know what it takes to cover, and we have enough resources. Sometimes there's a cost associated with that. Sometimes it's a greater cost because of overtime backfill and so forth. But, yes, we take all that into consideration.
We are talking about Indianapolis emergency preparedness here on No Limits in the aftermath, obviously, of the tragedy in Boston yesterday. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, were there lessons that were drawn from the Super Bowl experience? Did we change things following that? Anything that revealed itself? Megan Bolla, I imagine you guys watched that experience pretty closely. Were there lessons you drew from that?
We did. We worked very closely with the Super Bowl folks. Obviously, Indianapolis is known for hosting large-scale events, so they also leaned upon us and our experience in hosting those events as well. Everything from security to volunteers to crowd control, these are all things that, you know, we kind of watched, and it went off very smoothly. I didn't hear very many complaints. But again, we kind of used part of their security plan to help rewrite ours because it did work so well. So that was a good baseline for us.
And in what ways did you rewrite it? I mean, what changes?
Without going into specifics, because our security plan is not released to the public for security purposes, but again, it's kind of taking some of the decision making out. So if A were to happen, B automatically happens. So kind of, again, just taking the decision making out of the process. So you know if certain things happen, there is a consequence directly afterwards.
And Chief Sanford, what lessons did you and your department draw from the Super Bowl experience?
Well, some of the things that that we learned and changed in conjunction with the Super Bowl, obviously that is a one of the biggest events in the world, and with that comes heightened levels of security and more steps, particularly at the federal level, you have to take. One of the things that we did was move the Regional Operations Center, which is a command center. We moved it to the Eastgate facility on Shadeland. And that center is now set up and established, and we use it for all major events now. And it'll be every one of these events we're talking about, it will be operational, it will be staffed, and it'll be set up. The other thing is the partnerships that we developed. We've always worked with the other agencies, and again, particularly at the federal level, but those relationships are really rock solid now. I mean, we have a daily contact. We have people working with them on a daily basis, and that brings a whole other set of resources that really we just have to pick up the phone and call for. We've always enjoyed very good cooperation among local agencies, other fire departments, other police agencies, and so forth. And this now we're two steps above that as a result of the Super Bowl, and it allowed us to develop what are called incident management teams, people who are trained not just in incident command, but job-specific incident command. We now have all
what
those.
What is that distinction?
Some are trained in the ability for planning stages. Some are job-specific to logistics, getting equipment, getting supplies. Some are trained to just the finance aspect of it, tracking man hours used, tracking supplies used, some in all the logistical resources of equipment. So we had always have had a general command presence, but now we have individuals trained in those specific categories of the incident management plan.
We have gotten a tweet question via Twitter from a listener named Sarah. And if you want to connect with us via Facebook or Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. You also can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Sarah's question is, can our panelists talk about the process after a tragedy like this, about how states share their investigation, new crisis plans, et cetera? What's the reflection piece, or how, you know, when something like this happens, I imagine it does, everybody takes a step back and says, okay, what do we do now? Betty Dopkins.
Certainly there is that. I know when we have big successful events here in Indianapolis, my experience has been I've had other police departments contacting me saying, hey, can we have a copy of your plan? So we'll send them a plan. Sometimes we send police officers to other jurisdictions to see what they do or what they have done and actually not participate, but be with officers during an event to see how they handle things. And we do the same thing here. When you talk about Visit Indy, when they have major conventions, they will travel to other jurisdictions for the Super Bowl or FFA to see what is going on so that they can plan here. And by the same token, FFA has come here to see what Indy has done before the FFA has gone back to Kentucky for their 3 years. We've sent people to Dallas so they could prepare for their Super Bowl, New Orleans. So there is good feedback and sharing of information nationwide.
Chief Sanford, I'm going to reframe Sarah's question a little bit. With your, obviously, there are going to be lessons drawn from your counterparts in Boston. How do you share information with them? I mean, will there be a report filed from this that you all get access to, or is it done more informally? Will you talk with the chief of the Boston Fire Department? How do you draw what information there is or what lessons there are from an experience like this?
It's a combination. We have been already in constant communication. Every few hours we're in communication with the FBI. And other agencies. I can't really go into specifics because they're just now starting to make some determinations and release some information, but that is a constant information flow. Anytime there is any kind of credible information that there might, you know, possibly be an event, we get that right away. We have a federal and state fusion center set up that's just for sharing that information. And there will be they will do a case study on this particular incident, and there will be an after-action report that we will get copies of.
We've talked, obviously, about how we deal with something like this in the aftermath and really about how you help people, how all of that. Betty Dobkins had made reference to the fact that there's an investigative process that goes on here. Could you walk me through how that starts?
Well, from this, it's looking at people's injuries, it's looking at the surrounding damage, it's collecting the pieces of the bomb so they can start creating a signature, because bomb makers each has his or her own signature on how they build a bomb. They do the same thing over and over and over again, and it just becomes their fingerprint to creating this havoc. And so I would imagine the FBI and ATF have been collecting all of this information in order to start building this picture in reverse order.
Is it difficult to investigate a bombing like this? Because, I'm a layman. You're talking about signatures. But I would think, among other things, you made reference to fingerprints, the signature being the equivalent. I would think the explosion would take care of the fingerprints, too, if there are any that are there.
Well, what I was referring to, the fingerprint.
No, I'm not. I'm not quibbling with that. I guess what I'm saying is a lot of the evidence, it would seem, would also be destroyed by the explosion.
It is, but it's kind of like with evidence that's destroyed, there's also evidence brought in. So the explosion itself is evidence. And the pieces, parts that are left, the shrapnel, the pieces of the bomb that aren't destroyed, those little minute pieces help them build that picture in reverse. That's part of how they were able to recreate Oklahoma City.
And figure that out. So from there, once you've done that, sort of dealt with the physical evidence, what other things do you do?
Well, it's public service announcements, begging people to come forward with anything that they saw, setting up a tip line. Because some people think, well, that really wasn't important, but maybe what you did, what this thing is that you saw or heard, it might not be important to you, but it's another little piece of that puzzle that they can build on. So people should come forward with anything they saw, heard, smelled, and call tip lines when they set those up.
We are talking about Indianapolis emergency preparedness here on No Limits in the aftermath of the tragedy in Boston yesterday. My guests are Megan Bolla of the 500 Festival, Betty Dobkins, who is Director of Safety and Security for Indianapolis Downtown Incorporated, and Brian Sanford of the Indianapolis Fire Department. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about Indianapolis emergency preparedness here today. My guests are Megan Bolla, who is the communications manager for the 500 Festival, Betty Dobkins, who is director of safety and security for Indianapolis Downtown Incorporated, and Indianapolis Fire Department Chief Brian Sanford. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Chief Sanford, we were talking before the break about how we go about investigating crimes like this. Obviously, the fire department has a piece in that, too, when there's an explosion and fires. What's your piece of that?
Well, we work in conjunction with the other agencies. Part of ours is just maintaining scene security of the and preservation of the evidence itself, along with reporting. Everything is evidence. The injuries themselves are evidence, and certainly all the surroundings around what you see before you move it. You know, some things have to be moved. If there's debris on people, for example, all of that is maintained as evidence. And there's she's right. There certainly are pieces of the explosive device itself and so forth, and all of that tells a story. But there's also touch DNA.
What's that?
It's DNA that can be taken from, you know, for example, in Boston, we now know that there were explosive devices that went off, and there were some that didn't. And it's true that the ones that did go off may have destroyed DNA evidence that would be associated with them. But that doesn't mean they won't ultimately be able to pull DNA evidence from the ones that didn't go off. So there are ways of doing that. Certainly there are video feeds everywhere. All of the businesses around, and that's not even taking into account individuals who are shooting video of the race that might capture something accidentally that will later be useful as evidence. Businesses that surround the area are all using video cameras. So there is a lot of video evidence that will be poured over that may very well give, you know, some indication of what took place as well.
Well, in terms of also the tracking down of the information afterwards, I mean, some of this, and it's not specific to this event. It happens every time we have it, where there's all sorts of false information that floats around. I mean, at one point, supposedly the JFK library had been victim of an explosion. There was a rumor going on about that, and I think there were fluctuating numbers of unexploded devices that people were supposed to find. How difficult is it to determine what's real and what isn't, and how important is it to make sure that those rumors don't take life? Betty Dobkins.
Oh, it's very important, and every lead, every report like that has to be investigated because you just can't blow it off. You've got to check everything out, and, you know, something that might not even be true could lead to something else, and it's just, it's frustrating, and it takes away from the actual investigation, but you cannot ignore it.
Chief Sanford, how important is it also to some of that is a product of panic? I'm sure if I had been in Boston yesterday, anywhere near that finish line, my first response would have been terror. How do we go about, you know, tamping that down, reassuring people that they're going to be safe?
I think controlling the message is probably the best way you can do that. You know, immediately whenever the explosions occurred, you had several things. You had some people that thought it was just fireworks in celebration of the event. You had some people immediately assumed it was terrorism. I think that is why they try to be very careful at sending out a message of what might have happened until they actually have a good indication of what did happen. Was it just something at one of the food vendors that exploded? I mean, there are any number of things that can happen. If
yeah,
you
was
put
it
out
some accidental thing, as
yeah,
opposed
you,
to a deliberate act.
You put out the speculation, and it kind of can be a distraction that steers the investigation in the wrong way or steers people's leads coming in the wrong way. So that's why they're very careful at not releasing anything until they know it to be fact.
Got a good question from a listener named Bridget via Facebook, and you can connect with us on Facebook at WFYI. It says, is there a role for volunteers either on a long-term or immediate crisis basis? I'll leave that one with you first, Chief Sanford.
There's always a role for volunteers. It's sometimes difficult at the event itself if people want to volunteer and walk up at, you know, after something has happened, certainly. But volunteers are always welcome in advance so that you can do proper screening. You have a handle on how they're going to be utilized and so forth. There's always a place for volunteers to help.
What sorts of volunteers are the ones who are most helpful?
Well, from my perspective, the most helpful ones are firefighters, maybe from other agencies that have that experience and have that skill set, or EMS workers and so forth. But they might be better to answer in other areas.
Betty Dobkins, what other volunteers are helpful?
I think it's important to reiterate what Chief Sanford said, is that we need to know who the volunteers are, first of all, and it needs to be organized. You know, we just can't have folks running up to the scene to volunteer because they're trying to get the scene under control and stabilized. So the best thing is to have, unless it's firefighters or police officers or medical folks, it's best to wait until a call is put out for volunteers. I would think that it would be nice to have, you know, folks in the mental health field be volunteers, because they're going to be people
do
who
crisis counseling,
right? Crisis mm-hmm. counseling, and people who don't have the funds necessarily to go to a therapist. So, I think those folks would be greatly welcomed.
Is there a place for volunteers who don't necessarily have? I mean, those are fairly specific and specialized areas of expertise. I mean, I'm not a trained firefighter or an EMS or anything like that. But if I have a desire to help, even doing something like, you know, bringing down coffee or food for those of you who are working around the clock, is that helpful? Chief Sanford.
Usually we like for those to be. No, not, it's not that you get in the way. It's just that in those kinds of situations, we have to be very careful with who's coming in the scene. Because if we've never seen you before and it's not an organized effort, we don't know if you're bringing us Snickers bars in a backpack or if you're bringing another backpack with explosives. And then that diverts our attention to making sure that the security side of it is taking place also. So being organized before the event is much more helpful to us.
How obviously, I would think in the days since 9/11, you know, and it's now, this has become part of our lives. I mean, even predating 9/11, we had the Atlanta bombing, you know, at the Olympics and things like this. How much have we had to step up security, and how much more, just as a society, do we have to spend on trying to make events like this safe? Do you have any idea, Betty Dobkins?
I can't venture a guess on that. I think it's exponential. And now we do have security at all of our events. We have, you know, private security who assists with things. You have volunteers. I can see the cost may go up a little now. But as to an exact number, I couldn't tell you that.
Megan Bullough, do you have to budget more now for security because of events like this?
Well, we have a lot of great public safety agencies around the city that do donate their time, so that is obviously a big help for us. But we do hire private security as well. It has just become more and more part of the planning conversation over the past few years than it ever had been in years past. So of course, that's something that we're going to have to look at again. But, you know, private security and agencies, volunteers, just more hands on deck helping out and helping plan. And no one wants to sit down and plan these scenarios, but it's very important to. It's not a fun conversation to have, the what ifs, but obviously very important in the long run.
How often do you have those what if conversations? I mean, obviously, the bulk of what you do, you want to say, how can we make this a great event so people have a lot of fun here and they're satisfied by the time they spend here? So it's probably a bit of a downer, I would think, to have to turn around and say, well, you know, what do we do if none of that comes true and, in fact, something really awful happens?
Sure, and it's multiple conversations because each one of our events takes place at a different venue, a different part of downtown. It's a different kind of event, so it's not just a one-size-fits-all plan. We have plans for every single one of our events, and we work with you know, public safety officials all year round. I think Betty mentioned the planning never stops. We will have obviously a recap and spend most of, you know, June and July really talking about what went well, what didn't go well for the events, but then we go right into planning for the next year again. We are in a fortunate situation that a lot of our events have been taking place for years, some even decades. So we've had the luxury of kind of figuring a lot of those things out over time. But as things like this change, you know, the conversation has to change.
What should I want to take this back to something a little more hopeful, because we've been talking really about awful things that could happen. What should people do if they want to come to, say, the mini marathon or the 500 festival parade? What steps should they take to know that they'll be safe, but also that they're going to have a great time doing that? I'll keep it with you, Megan, and then we'll take it around the horn.
Sure. You know, ultimately, we want to plan safe, fun events, and it is important for people not to live in fear and to be able to enjoy some of these great amenities and events that the city hosts. I mean, the month of May in Indianapolis should be a magical time. It shouldn't be a fearful time. So just knowing that a lot of people are working behind the scenes to make sure that it is safe so you can enjoy these events and not have to worry about that. That being said, we have talked today about being aware of your surroundings, and it is a group effort. It is, we're asking every single set of eyes at all of our events to make sure that you know, everything goes smoothly.
Betty Dobkins, what should people do to make sure that they're going to have a, you know, May has always been a big time in Indiana. What should they do to make sure that they have a good time at all of these special events and that they're also safe?
It's there again, just being aware. I just don't believe that there's a terrorist under every bush and that we're all going to be a victim. You know, look at airplane safety has, you know, increased incredibly. You know, the United States hasn't had an airplane crash in how many years? And it's just because we've gotten better at what we do. We need to continue with our lives and do the fun things that we always do. We can't let folks control us or, you know, live in fear. I have a friend today who said, I'm supposed to go to the marathon in Louisville. And you know what? I'm still going to go because I'm not going to let them win. So keep coming downtown. If we have people continuing to do these events and you're aware and you report something that you see as suspicious, we're going to be safe.
Chief Sanford, same question to you. What can we do to make sure we have a good time but still are safe?
Yeah, a lot of it's the same answer. You know, if you want to come, come. We can't let the fear of what might happen prevent us from living our lives. You can rest assured that a lot of planning and preparation has been done. We have plans in place to offer the greatest degree of security and safety that we can, and certainly we have a good response plan in the event something does happen. One of the things that probably could be helpful, though, is for people to just remember this. You know, we tend to react as a nation or as a people. We tend to react. We heighten security. And then as time goes on and events don't happen, then we start to complain about that very same security that we heighten. And over time, when it happens enough, then there is a tendency to start reducing that security until something happens again. So just that's something that individuals can do also. Just be patient. understand that the security measures are in place and all these things are there for safety, and don't let time of not having occurrences happen make us want to do away with those security measures.
Well said.
I also want to say, ask a question, because we've said over and over again during this program that if you see something, you should say something, you should report it. How does one go about doing that? What's the best way to do it so that it's taken seriously? Because let's assume, say, in Boston, somebody had spotted someone around one of the trash cans. I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm dealing with a hypothetical here. And they wanted to try to point that out to somebody who could do something about it. What's the appropriate way to do that, Chief Sanford?
Well, find a safety official and tell them. Go point it out. Whether you think, it's just an outside chance it could be something, it's worth reporting. If you see it, if it looks unusual to you, go find a police officer, go find a firefighter, go find somebody and let them know. You can also send things out over Twitter. All of the social media sites, the common sites, are very well monitored. We have systems in place now that monitor those sites, and if it goes out over Twitter, it's going to be noticed, and that information will be relayed to the appropriate agency. And then the third, IMPD certainly is an agency that you can call and report any kind of suspicious activity, but we're putting a see something, say something designated line in place. We're currently coming up with the number for it. And not in just response to this, but we're going to run it 24/7, 365 days a year, and that will be a well-publicized number.
On something like this, suppose I see something that looks suspicious, and I'm doubtful there's not a police officer handy, because I think that's more reassuring to people, is to be able to actually walk up and talk to a human being. And suppose I'm not well-versed in either Facebook or Twitter. Is it something where you do a 911 call, Betty?
Certainly. It never question calling 911 in circumstances like that. And another thing you can do, for instance, the mini marathon, all their volunteers, you go tell one of their volunteers. They have either a radio or a phone. They've been directed on who to call in their organization to report things like this. So they're prepared to handle those types of incidents too, to make notification to public safety.
And we probably, to reassure people, also ought to say that if it turns out that it was just a teenager who left a backpack filled with video games and not something, that there's not a penalty for you making that call, or you're not going to get the kid in trouble either, right? Is that the case, Betty Dodkins?
Oh, of course not. We want people calling, and if you are suspicious, by all means call. There's no penalty for that. Not at all. It's not a prank. If you're scared, have anxiety about it, you're not sure, it's better to call than to ignore it.
I think that will be the last word. I'd like to thank all of you for coming in on this sad and crowded day to be with us. Megan Bulla, it's been a somber pleasure to talk with you today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and we look forward to seeing everyone in May.
Certainly. Betty Dodkins, thank you very much for being with us. And Chief Sanford, thank you very much for making time in your busy schedule. We really appreciate it. You have been listening to No Limits. We will be back on Thursday when we are going to be talking about Afghanistan. I am John Krall. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.